dampened with her spit.
"My poor Sam," she murmured. "My poor, poor Sam."
"It will be good to see her again," he thought, as he clung to Blackbird's rail and watched waves breaking on the stony shore. "If she saw me in my blacks, it might even make her proud. I'm a man now, Mother," I could tell her. "A steward and a man of the night's watch. My brothers call me Sam the Slayer sometimes." He would see his brother Dickon, too, and his sisters. "See," I could tell them, "see, I was good for something after all." If he went to Hornhill, though, his father might be there. The thought made his belly heave again. Sam bent over the gunwale and retched, but not into the wind. He had gone to the right rail this time. He was getting good at retching. Or so he thought, until Blackbird left the land behind and struck east across the bay for the shores of Skagos. The island sat at the mouth of the Bay of Seals, massive and mountainous, a stark and forbidding land peopled by savages. They lived in caves and grim mountain fastnesses, Sam had read, and rode great shaggy unicorns to war. Skagos meant stone in the old tongue. The Skagosi named themselves the Stoneborn, but their fellow Northmen called them Skags, and liked them little. Only 100 years ago, Skagos had risen in rebellion. Their revolt had taken years to quell, and claimed the life of the Lord of Winterfell and hundreds of his sworn swords. Some song said the Skags were cannibals. Supposedly their warriors ate the hearts and livers of the men they slew. In ancient days, the Skagosi had sailed to the nearby isle of Skane, seized its women, slaughtered its men, and ate them on a pebbled beach in a feast that lasted for a fortnight. Skane remained unpeopled to this day. Derry knew the songs as well. When the bleak grey peaks of Skagos rose up from the sea, he joined Sam at Blackbird's prow and said, "If the gods are good, we may catch a glimpse of a unicorn."
"If the captain is good, we won't come that close. The currents are treacherous round Skagos, and there are rocks that can crack a ship's hull like an egg. But don't you mention that to Jilly. She's scared enough. Her and that squalling whelp of hers. I don't know which of them is noisier. The only time he ever stops crying is when she shoves a nipple in his mouth. And then she starts to sob."
Sam had noticed it as well.
"Maybe the babe is hurting her," he said feebly, "if his teeth are coming in."
Darian plucked at his lute with one finger, sending up a derisive note.
"I'd heard that wildlings were braver than that."
"She is brave," Sam insisted, though even he had to admit that he had never seen Jilly in such a wretched state. Though she hid her face more oft than not and kept her cabin dark, he could see that her eyes were always red, her cheeks wet with tears. When he asked her what was wrong, though, she only shook her head, leaving him to find answers of his own.
"The sea scares her, that's all," he told Darian. "Before she came to the wall, all she knew was Craister's Keep and the woods around it. I don't know that she went more than half a league from the place that she was born. She knows streams and rivers, but she had never seen a lake until we came on one. And the sea, oh, the sea is a scary thing. We've never been out of sight of land. We will be."
Sam did not relish that part himself.
"Surely a little water doesn't frighten the Slayer."
"No," Sam lied,
"not me, but Jilly. Maybe if you played some lullabies for them, it would help the babe to sleep."
Darren's mouth twisted in disgust.
"Only if she shoves a plug up his arse. I cannot abide the smell."
The next day the rains began, and the seas grew rougher.
"We had best go below where it's dry,"
Sam said to Eamon. But the old maester only smiled and said,
"The rain feels good against my face, Sam. It feels like tears. Let me stay a while longer, I pray you. It has been a long time since last I wept."
If Maester Aemon had meant to stay on deck, old and frail as he was, Sam had no choice but to do the same. He stayed beside the old man for nigh unto an hour, huddled in his cloak as a soft steady rain soaked him to his skin. Aemon hardly seemed to feel it. He sighed and closed his eyes, and Sam moved closer to him to shield him from the worst of the wind.
"He will ask me to help him to the cabin soon," he told himself. "He must."
But he never did, and finally thunder began to rumble in the distance off to the east.
"We have to get below," Sam said, shivering.
Maester Aemon did not reply. It was only then that Sam realized that the old man had gone to sleep.
"Maester," he said, shaking him gently by one shoulder, "Maester Aemon, wake up."
Aemon's blind, white eye came open.
"Egg," he said,
as the rain streamed down his cheeks.
"Egg, I dreamed that I was old."
Sam did not know what to do. He knelt and scooped the old man up and carried him below. No one had ever called him strong, and the rain had soaked through Maester Aemon's blacks and made him twice as heavy. But even so, he weighed no more than a child. When he shoved into the cabin with Aemon in his arms, he found that Jilly had let all the candles gutter out. The babe was asleep, and she was curled up in a corner, sobbing softly in the folds of the big black cloak that Sam had given her.
"Help me," he said urgently. "Help me dry him off and get him warm."
She rose at once, and together they got the old maester out of his wet clothes and buried him beneath a pile of furs. His skin was damp and cold, though, clammy to the touch.
"You get in with him,"
Sam told Jilly.
"Hold him, warm him with your body. We have to warm him up."
She did that too, never saying a word, all the while still sniffling.
"Where's Darien?" asked Sam. "We'd all be warmer if we were together. He needs to be here too."
He was headed back up top to find the singer when the deck rose up beneath him, then fell away beneath his feet. Jilly wailed. Sam slammed down hard and lost his legs, and the babe woke screaming. The next roll of the ship came as he was struggling back to his feet. It threw Jilly into his arms, and the wildling girl clung to him so fiercely that Sam could hardly breathe.
"Don't you be frightened," he told her. "This is just an adventure. One day you'll tell your son this tale."
That only made her dig her nails into his arm. She shuddered, her whole body shaking with the violence of her sobs.
"Whatever I say just makes her worse."
He held her tightly, uncomfortably aware of her breasts pressing up against him. As frightened as he was, somehow that was enough to make him stiff.
"She'll feel it,"
he thought, ashamed. But if she did, she gave no sign, only clung to him the harder. The days ran together after that. They never saw the sun. The days were grey and the nights black, except when lightning lit the sky above the peaks of Skagos. All of them were starved, yet none could eat. The captain broached a cask of fire wine to fortify the oarsmen. Sam tried a cup and sighed as hot snakes wriggled down his throat and through his chest. Darien took a liking to the drink as well, and was seldom sober thereafter. The sails went up, the sails came down, and one ripped free of the mast and flew away like a great grey bird. As Blackbird rounded the south coast of Skagos, they spotted the wreckage of a galley on the rocks. Some of her crew had washed up on the shore, and the rooks and crabs had gathered to pay them homage.
"Too bloody close," grumbled old Tattersalt when he saw. "One good blow, and we'll be breaking up aside them."
Exhausted as they were, his rowers bent to their oars again, and the ship clawed south toward the narrow sea, till Skagos dwindled to no more than a few dark shapes in the sky that might have been thunderheads, or the tops of tall black mountains, or both. After that they had 8 days and 7 nights of clear, smooth sailing.
Then came more storms, worse than before. Was it three storms, or only one, broken up by lulls? Sam never knew, though he tried desperately to care.
"What does it matter?"
Darien screamed at him once, when all of them were huddled in the cabin.
"It doesn't," Sam wanted to tell him, "but so long as I'm thinking about that, I'm not thinking about drowning, or being sick, or Maester Aemon shivering."
"It doesn't," he managed to squeak, but the thunder drowned out all the rest of it, and the deck lurched and knocked him sideways. Jilly was sobbing. The babe was shrieking. And up top he could hear old Tattersalt bellowing at his crew, the ragged captain who never spoke at all.
"I hate the sea," Sam thought. "I hate the sea, I hate the sea, I hate the sea."
The next lightning flash was so bright it lit the cabin through the seams in the planking overhead.
"This is a good sound ship, a good sound ship, a good ship," he told himself. "It will not sink. I am not afraid."
During one of the lulls between the gales, as Sam clung white-knuckled to the rail, wanting desperately to retch, he heard some of the crew muttering that this was what came of bringing a woman aboard ship, and a wildling woman at that.
"Fuck your own father,"
Sam heard one man say, as the wind was rising once again.
"Worse than whoring, that. Worse than anything. We'll all drown unless we get rid of her, and that abomination that she whelped."
Sam dared not confront them. They were older men, hard and sinewy, their arms and shoulders thickened by years at the oars. But he made certain that his knife was sharp, and whenever Jilly left the cabin to make water, he went with her. Even Darien had no good to say about the wilding girl. Once, at Sam's urging, the singer played a lullaby to soothe the babe. But partway through the first verse, Jilly began to sob inconsolably.
"Seven bloody elves," Darien snapped. "Can't you even stop weeping long enough to hear a song?" "Just play," Sam pleaded. "Just sing the song for her."
"She doesn't need a song," said Darien. "She needs a good spanking or maybe a hard fuck." "Get out of my way, Slayer."
He shoved Sam aside and went for the cabin to find some solace in a cup of fire wine and the rough brotherhood of the oars. Sam was at his wit's end by then. He had almost gotten used to the smells, but between the storms and Jilly's sobbing, he had not slept for days.
"Isn't there something you can give her?" he asked Maester Aemon very softly, when he saw that the old man was awake. "Some herb or potion, so she won't be so afraid." "It is not fear, you hear," the old man told him. "That is the sound of grief, and there is no potion for that. Let her tears run their course, Sam. You cannot stem the flow."
Sam had not understood.
"She's going to a safe place, a warm place. Why should she be grieving?" "Sam," the old man whispered, "you have two good eyes, and yet you do not see. She is a mother grieving for her child." "He's green sick, that's all. We're all green sick. Once we make port in Braavos, the babe will still be Darla's son and not the child of her body." It took Sam a moment to grasp what Aemon was suggesting. "That couldn't... She wouldn't. Of course he's hers. Jilly would never have left the wall without her son. She loves him." "She nursed them both and loved them both," said Aemon, "but not alike. No mother loves all her children the same, not even the mother above. Jilly did not leave the child willingly, I am certain. What threats the Lord Commander made, what promises, I can only guess. But threats and promises there surely were."
"No, no, that's wrong. John would never—"
"John would never. Lord Snow did. Sometimes there is no happy choice, Sam. Only one less grievous than the others."
"No happy choice."
Sam thought of all the trials that he and Jilly suffered. Craister's Keep, and the death of the old bear, snow and ice and freezing winds, days and days and days of walking,
the whites at White Tree, Cold Hands, and the Tree of Ravens, the wall, the wall, the wall, the black gate beneath the earth. What has it all been for?
No happy choices, and no happy endings.
He wanted to scream. He wanted to howl and sob and shake and curl up in a little ball and whimper.
He switched the babes, he told himself. He switched the babes to protect the little prince, to keep him away from Lady Melisandre's fires, away from her red god. If she burns Gilly's boy, who will care? No one but Gilly. He was only Creaster's whelp, an abomination born of incest, not the son of the king beyond the wall. He's no good for a hostage, no good for a sacrifice, no good for anything. He doesn't even have a name.
Wordless, Sam staggered up onto the deck to Rich, but there was nothing in his belly to bring up. Night had come upon them, a strange, still night, such as they had not seen for many days. The sea was black as glass. At the oars the rowers rested. One or two were sleeping where they sat. The wind was in the sails, and to the north Sam could even see a scattering of stars, and the red wanderer the free folk called the Thief.
That ought to be my star, Sam thought miserably. I helped to make John Lord Commander, and I brought him Gilly and the babe. There are no happy endings.
Slayer! Darien appeared beside him, oblivious to Sam's pain. A sweet night for once. Look, the stars are coming out. We might even get a bit of moon. Might be the worst is done.
No.
Sam wiped his nose and pointed south with a fat finger toward the gathering darkness.
There, he said.
No sooner had he spoken than lightning flashed, sudden and silent and blinding bright. The distant clouds glowed for half a heartbeat. Mountains heaped on mountains, purple and red and yellow, taller than the world.
The worst isn't done. The worst is just beginning. And there are no happy endings.
Gods be good, said Darien, laughing. Slayer, you are such a craven.
Jamie. Lord Tywin Lannister had entered the city on a stallion, his enameled crimson armour polished and gleaming, bright with gems and goldwork. He left it in a tall wagon draped with crimson banners, with six silent sisters riding attendance on his bones. The funeral procession departed King's Landing through the Gate of the Gods, wider and more splendid than the Lion Gate. The choice felt wrong to Jaime. His father had been a lion, that no one could deny, but even Lord Tywin never claimed to be a god. An honour guard of 50 knights surrounded Lord Tywin's wagon. Crimson pennons fluttered from their lances. The lords of the west followed close behind them. The wind snapped at their banners, making their chargers dance and flutter. As he trotted up the column, Jaime passed boars, badgers, and beetles. A green arrow and a red ox, crossed halberds, crossed spears, a tree cat, a strawberry, a monch, four sunbursts counterchanged. Lord Brax was wearing a pale grey doublet slashed with cloth of silver, an amethyst unicorn pinned above his heart. Lord Jast was armoured in black steel, three gold lion's heads inlaid on his breastplate. The rumours of his death had not been far wrong, to look at him. Wounds and imprisonment had left him a shadow of the man he'd been. Lord Bannerford had weathered battle better, and looked ready to return to war at once. Plum wore purple, Prester ermine, Morland russet and green, but each had donned a cloak of crimson silk in honour of the man they were escorting home. Behind the lords came 100 crossbowmen and 300 men-at-arms, and crimson flowed from their shoulders as well. In his white cloak and white scale armour, Jaime felt out of place amongst that river of red. nor did his uncle make him more at ease. "A Lord Commander," Sir Kevin said, when Jamie trotted up beside him at the head of the column. "Does Her Grace have some last command for me?" "I am not here for Cersei." A drum began to beat behind them, slow, measured, funereal. "Dead," it seemed to say. "Dead. Dead. I came to make my farewells." He was my father. "And hers." "I am not Cersei. I have a beard, and she has breasts. If you are still confused, uncle, count our hands. Cersei has two." "Both of you have a taste for mockery," his uncle said. "Spare me your japes, sir. I have no taste for them." "As you will." This is not going as well as I might have hoped. "Cersei would have wanted to see you off, but she has many pressing duties." Sir Kevin snorted. "So do we all. How fares your king?" His tone made the question a reproach. "Well enough," Jaime said defensively. "Balon Swan is with him during the mornings. A good and valiant knight. Once that went without saying, when men spoke of those who wore the white cloak." "No man can choose his brothers," Jaime thought. "Give me leave to pick my own men, and the king's guard will be great again." "Put that baldly, though. It sounded feeble. An empty boast from a man the realm called Kingslayer. A man with shit for honour." Jaime let it go. He had not come to argue with his uncle. "Sir," he said, "you need to make your peace with Cersei."
"Are we at war? No one told me."
Jaime ignored that. "Strife between Lannister and Lannister can only help the enemies of our house.
If there is a strife, it will not be my doing. Cersei wants to rule, well and good. The realm is hers. All I ask is to be left in peace. My place is at Dari with my son. The castle must needs be restored, the lands planted and protected."
He gave a bark of bitter laughter.
"Ha ha! And your sister has left me little else to occupy my time. I had as well see Lancel wed. His bride has grown impatient, waiting for us to make our way to Dari."
His widow from the twins. His cousin Lancel was riding 10 yards behind them. With his hollow eyes and dry white hair, he looked older than Lord Jest. Jaime could feel his phantom fingers itching at the sight of him. "Fucking Lancel and Osmond, Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know..." He had tried to speak with Lancel more times than he could count, but never found him alone. If his father was not with him, some septon was. "He may be Kevin's son, but he has milk in his veins. Tyrion was lying to me. His words were meant to wound." Jaime put his cousin from his thoughts and turned back to his uncle. "Will you remain at Derry after the wedding?"
"For a while, mayhaps. Sandor Clegane is raiding along the Trident, it would seem. Your sister wants his head. It may be that he has joined Dondarrion."
Jaime had heard about salt pans. By now half the realm had heard. The raid had been exceptionally savage. Women raped and mutilated, children butchered in their mother's arms, half the town put to the torch. "Randall Tarly is at Maidenpool. Let him deal with the outlaws. I would sooner have you go to Riverrun."
"Sir Devon has command there. The Warden of the West. He has no need of me. Lancel does."
"As you say, uncle." Jaime's head was pounding to the same beat as the drum. "Dead, dead, dead. You would do well to keep your knights around you." His uncle gave him a cool stare.
"Is that a threat, sir?"
"A threat?" The suggestion took him aback.
"A caution. I only meant Sandor is dangerous. I was hanging outlaws and robber knights when you were still shitting in your swaddling clothes. I'd not like to go off and face Clegane and Dondarrion by myself, if that's what you fear, sir. Not every Lannister is a fool for glory."
"Why, uncle, I believe you're talking about me.
Adam Marbrand could deal with these outlaws just as well as you. So could Brax, Bainfort, Plum,
any of these others. But none would make a good king's hand. Your sister knows my terms. They have not changed. Tell her that the next time you are in her bedchamber. Sir Kevin put his heels into his courser and galloped ahead, putting an abrupt end to their conversation. Jamie let him go, his missing sword hand twitching. He had hoped against hope that Cersei had somehow misunderstood, but plainly that was wrong. He knows about the two of us, about Tommen and Myrcella, and Cersei knows he knows. Sir Kevin was a Lannister of Castle Rock. He could not believe that she would ever do him harm, but I was wrong about Tyrion. Why not Cersei? When sons were killing fathers, what was there to stop a niece from ordering an uncle slain? An inconvenient uncle who knows too much. Though perhaps Cersei was hoping that the Hound might do her work for her. If Sandor Clegane cut down Sir Kevin, she would not need to bloody her own hands, and he will, if they should meet. Kevin Lannister had once been a stout man with a sword, but he was no longer young, and the Hound? The column had caught up to him. As his cousin rode past, flanked by his two septons, Jamie called out to him, "Lancel, Cars, I wanted to congratulate you upon your marriage. I only regret that my duties do not permit me to attend. His grace must be protected. And will be. Still, I hate to miss your bedding. It is your first marriage, and her second, I understand. I'm sure my lady will be pleased to show you what goes where." The bawdy remark drew a laugh from several nearby lords, and a disapproving look from Lancel's septons. His cousin squirmed uncomfortably in the saddle. "I know enough to do my duty as a husband, sir. That's just the thing a bride wants on her wedding night," said Jamie. "A husband who knows how to do his duty." A flush crept up Lancel's cheeks. "I pray for you, cousin, and her grace the queen. May the crone lead her to her wisdom and the warrior defend her." "Why would Cersei need the warrior? She has me." Jamie turned his horse about, his white cloak snapping in the wind. The imp was lying. Cersei would sooner have Robert's corpse between her legs than a pious fool like Lancel. "Tyrion, you evil bastard, you should have lied about someone more likely." He galloped past his lord father's funeral wain toward the city in the distance. The streets of King's Landing seemed almost deserted as Jaime Lannister made his way back to the Red Keep atop Aegon's High Hill. The soldiers who had crowded the city's gambling dens and pot shops were largely gone now. Garland the Gallant had taken half the Tyrell strength back to Highgarden, and his lady mother and grandmother had gone with him. The other half had marched south, with Mace Tyrell and Mathis Rowan, to invest Storm's End. As for the Lannister host, 2,000 seasoned veterans remained encamped outside the city walls, awaiting the arrival of Paxter Redwind's fleet to carry them across Blackwater Bay to Dragonstone. Lord Stannis appeared to have left only a small garrison behind him when he sailed north, so 2,000 men would be more than sufficient, Cersei had judged. The rest of the Westermen had gone back to their wives and children, to rebuild their homes, plant their fields, and bring in one last harvest. Cersei had taken Tommen round their camps before they marched, to let them cheer their little king. She had never looked more beautiful than she did that day, with a smile on her lips and the autumn sunlight shining on her golden hair. Whatever else one might say about his sister, she did know how to make men love her when she cared enough to try. As Jamie trotted through the castle gates, he came upon 2 dozen knights riding at a quintain in the outer yard. "Something else I can no longer do," he thought. A lance was heavier and more cumbersome than a sword, and swords were proving trial enough. He supposed he might try holding the lance with his left hand, but that would mean shifting his shield to the right arm. In a tilt, A man's foe was always to the left. A shield on the right arm would prove as useful as nipples on his breastplate.
No, my jousting days are done, he thought as he dismounted. But all the same, he stopped to watch a while. Sir Tathered the Tall lost his mount when the sandbag came round and thumped him in the head. Strongbore struck the shield so hard he cracked it. Kenneth of Case finished the destruction. A new shield was hung for Sir Dermot of the Rainwood. Lambert Turnberry only struck a glancing blow, but beardless John Betley, Humphrey Swift, and Alan Staxpear all scored solid hits, and Red Ronnet Connington broke his lance clean. Then the Knight of Flowers mounted up and put the others all to shame. Jousting was three-quarters horsemanship, Jamie had always believed. Sir Loras rode superbly, and handled a lance as if he'd been born holding one, which, no doubt, accounted for his mother's pinched expression.
He puts the point just where he means to put it, and seems to have the balance of a cat. Perhaps it was not such a fluke that he unhorsed me. It was a shame that he would never have the chance to try the boy again. He left the whole men to their sport.
Circe was in her solar, in Magor's Holdfast, with Tommen and Lord Merryweather's dark-haired, Meerish wife. The three of them were laughing at Grand Maester Pycelle. "Did I miss some clever jape?" Jamie said, as he shoved through the door.
"Oh, look," purred Lady Merryweather. "Your brave brother has returned, Your Grace."
"Most of him." The Queen was in her cups, Jamie realized. Of late Circe always seemed to have a flagon of wine to hand, she who had once scorned Robert Baratheon for his drinking. He misliked that, but these days he seemed to mislike everything his sister did. "Grand Maester," she said, "share the tidings with the Lord Commander, if you would." Pycelle looked desperately uncomfortable.
"There has been a bird," he said. "From Stokeworth, Lady Tandy sends word that her daughter Lollys has been delivered of a strong, healthy son."
"And you will never guess what they have named the little bastard brother." "They wanted to name him Tywin, I recall." "Yes, but I forbade it. I told Felice that I would not have our father's noble name bestowed upon the ill-gotten spawn of some pig-boy and a feeble-witted sow."
"Lady Stokeworth insists the child's name was not her doing,"
Grandmaster Pycelle put in. Perspiration dotted his wrinkled forehead.
"Lolly's husband made the choice," she writes. "This man, Bronn, it would seem that
Tyrion," ventured Jamie. "He named the child Tyrion." The old man gave a tremulous nod, mopping at his brow with the sleeve of his robe. Jamie had to laugh. "There you are, sweet sister. You have been looking everywhere for Tyrion, and all the time he's been hiding in Lolly's womb. Droll. You and Bronn are both so droll. No doubt the bastard is sucking on one of Lolly's Lackwood stugs, even as we speak, whilst this sellsword looks on, smirking at his little insolence."
"Perhaps this child bears some resemblance to your brother," suggested Lady Merryweather. "He might have been born deformed or without a nose."
She laughed a throaty laugh. "We shall have to send the darling boy a gift," the Queen declared. "Won't we, Tommen?"
"We could send him a kitten."
"A lion cub," said Lady Merryweather, "to whip his little throat out,"
her smile suggested. "I had a different sort of gift in mind," said Circe. "A new stepfather, most like." Jamie knew the look in his sister's eyes. He had seen it before, most recently on the night of Tommen's wedding, when she burned the tower over the hand. The green light of the wildfire had bathed the faces of the watchers, so they looked like nothing so much as rotting corpses, a pack of gleeful ghouls. But some of the corpses were prettier than others. Even in the baleful glow, Circe had been beautiful to look upon. She stood with one hand on her breast, her lips parted, her green eyes shining. "She is crying," Jamie had realized, but whether it was from grief or ecstasy, he could not have said. The sight had filled him with disquiet, reminding him of Aerys Targaryen and the way a burning would arouse him. A king has no secrets from his king's guard. Relations between Aerys and his queen had been strained during the last years of his reign. They slept apart and did their best to avoid each other during the waking hours. But whenever Aerys gave a man to the flames, Queen Rhaella would have a visitor in the night. The day he burned his mace and dagger hand, Jaime and John Derry had stood at guard outside her bedchamber whilst the king took his pleasure.
"You're hurting me!"
they had heard Rhaella cry through the oaken door.
"You're hurting me!"
In some queer way, that had been worse than Lord Chelsted screaming. "We are sworn to protect her as well," Jaime had finally been driven to say.
"We are," Derry allowed, "but not from him."
Jaime had only seen Rhaella once after that, the morning of the day she left for Dragonstone. The queen had been cloaked and hooded as she climbed inside the royal wheelhouse that would take her down Aegon's high hill to the waiting ship, but he heard her maids whispering after she was gone. They said the queen looked as if some beast had savaged her, clawing at her thighs and chewing on her breasts. A crowned beast, Jaime knew. By the end, the Mad King had become so fearful that he would allow no blade in his presence, save for the swords his king's guard wore. His beard was matted and unwashed, his hair a silver-gold tangle that reached his waist. His fingernails cracked yellow claws 9 inches long. Yet still the blades tormented him, the ones he could never escape, the blades of the Iron Throne. His arms and legs were always covered with scabs and half-healed cuts. "Let him be king over charred bones and cooked meat," Jaime remembered, studying his sister's smile. "Let him be the king of ashes."
"Your Grace," he said, "might we have a private word?"
"Oh, as you wish. Tommen, it's past time you had your lesson for the day. Go with the Grand Maester." "Yes, Mother. We are learning about Baelor the Blessed."
Lady Meriwether took her leave as well, kissing the Queen on both cheeks. "Shall I return for supper, Your Grace?"
"I shall be very cross with you if you do not."
Jaime could not help but note the way the Meerish woman moved her hips as she walked. Every step is a seduction. When the door closed behind her, he cleared his throat and said, "First these Kettleblacks, then Kyburn, now her. It's a queer menagerie you're keeping these days, sweet sister. I'm growing very fond of Lady Taina. She amuses me." "She is one of Marjorie Tyrell's companions," Jaime reminded her. "She's informing on you to the little queen."
"Of course she is."
Cersei went to the sideboard to fill her cup anew. "Marjorie was thrilled when I asked her to leave to take Taina on as my companion. You should have heard her. She will be a sister to you, as she has been to me. Of course you must have her." "I have my cousins and my other ladies." "Our little queen does not want me to be lonely." "If you know she is a spy, why take her on?" "Oh, Marjorie is not half so clever as she thinks. She has no notion what a sweet serpent she has in that Meerish slot. I use Taina to feed the little queen what I want her to know. Some of it is even true." Cersei's eyes were bright with mischief. "And Taina tells me everything Maid Marjorie is doing."
"Oh, does she? How much do you know about this woman?"
"I know she is a mother with a young son, and that she wants to rise high in this world. She will do whatever is required to see that he does. Mothers are all the same. Lady Meriwether may be a serpent, but she is far from stupid. She knows I can do more for her
than Marjorie, so she makes herself useful to me. You would be surprised at all the interesting things she's told me.
What sort of things? Circe sat beneath the window.
Did you know that the Queen of Thorns keeps a chest of coins in her wheelhouse? Old gold from before the conquest. Should any tradesman be so unwise as to name a price in gold and coins, she pays him with hands from Highgarden, each half the weight of one of our dragons. What merchant would dare complain of being cheated by Mace Tyrell's lady mother? She sipped her wine and said, "Did you enjoy your little ride?"
"Our uncle remarked upon your absence."
"Our uncle's remarks do not concern me."
"They should. You make good use of him. If not at River Run or the Rock, then in the north, against Lord Stannis. Father always relied upon Kevin when—"
"Roos Bolton is our warden of the north. He will deal with Stannis. Lord Bolton is trapped below the neck, cut off from the north by the iron men of Moat Cailin."
"Oh, not for long. Bolton's bastard son will soon remove that little obstacle. Lord Bolton will have 2,000 Freys to augment his own strength, under Lord Walder's sons, Hustine and Aenys. That should be more than enough to deal with Stannis and a few thousand broken men. Sir Kevin will have his hands full at Derry, teaching Lancel how to wipe his arse. Father's death has unmanned him. He is an old Don man. Davin and Damien will serve us better."
"They'll suffice." Jamie had no quarrel with his cousins. "You still require a hand, however. If not our uncle, who?"
His sister laughed.
"Not you. Have no fear on that count. Perhaps Taina's husband. His grandfather was hand under Ares. The Horn of Plenty hand." Jamie remembered Owen Merryweather well enough, an amiable man, but ineffectual. "As I recall, he did so well that Ares exiled him and seized his lands. Robert gave them back, some at least. Taina would be pleased if Orton could recover the rest." "Is this about pleasing some meerish whore? Here I thought it was about governing the realm."
"I govern the realm."
"Seven save us all, you do." His sister liked to think of herself as Lord Tywin with teats, but she was wrong. Their father has been as relentless and implacable as a glacier when Cersei was all wildfire, especially when thwarted. She had been giddy as a maiden when she learned that Stannis had abandoned Dragonstone, certain that he had finally given up the fight and sailed away to exile. When word came down from the north that he had turned up again at the wall, her fury had been fearful to behold. She does not lack for wits, but she has no judgment and no patience. You need a strong hand to help you. A weak ruler needs a strong hand, as Ares needed father. A strong ruler requires only a diligent servant to carry out his orders. She swirled her wine. Lord Halen might suit. He would not be the first pyromancer to serve as the king's hand.
No, I killed the last one.
There is talk that you mean to make Oren Waters the master of ships. Has someone been informing on me? When he did not answer, Cersei tossed her hair back and said, Waters is well suited to the office. He has spent half his life on ships.
Half his life? He cannot be more than 20.
22. And what of it? Father was not even 21 when Aerys Targaryen named him hand.
It is past time Tommen had some young men about him in place of all these wrinkled greybeards.
Oren is strong and vigorous.
Strong and vigorous and handsome, Jamie thought. She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know.
Paxter Redwin would be a better choice. He commands the largest fleet in Westeros. Oren Waters could command a skiff, but only if you bought him one.
You are a child, Jamie. Redwin is Tyrell's banner man, and nephew to that hideous grandmother of his,
I want none of Lord Tyrell's creatures on my council.
Tommen's council, you mean? You know what I mean.
Too well. I know that Orin Waters is a bad idea, and Helene is a worse one. As for Qyburn, oh, gods be good, Cersei, he rode with Varga Hote. The Citadel stripped him of his chain. The Grey Sheep. Qyburn has made himself most useful to me, and he is loyal, which is more than I can say of my own kin.
Huh? The crows will feast upon us all if you go on this way, sweet sister.
Cersei, listen to yourself. You are seeing dwarfs in every shadow and making foes of friends. Uncle Kevin is not your enemy. I am not your enemy. Her face twisted in fury. I begged you for your help. I went down on my knees to you, and you refused me. My vows did not stop you slaying Aerys. Words are wind. You could have had me, but you chose a cloak instead. Get out. Sister, get out, I said. I'm sick of looking at that ugly stump of yours. Get out. To speed him on his way, she heaved her wine cup at his head. She missed, but Jaime took the hint. Evenfall found him sitting alone in the common room of White Sword Tower, with a cup of Dornish red and the white book. He was turning pages with the stump of his sword hand when the Knight of Flowers entered, removed his cloak and sword belt, and hung them on a wall peg next to Jaime's. "I saw you in the yard today," said Jaime. "You rode well."
"Better than well, surely."
Sir Loras poured himself a cup of wine and took a seat across the half-moon table. A more modest man might have answered, "My lord is too kind," or, "I had a good mount." The horse was adequate, and my lord is as kind as I am modest. Loras waved at the book. "Lord Renly always said that books were for maesters. This one is for us. The history of every man who has ever worn a white cloak is written here.
I have glanced at it. The shields are pretty. I prefer books with more illuminations.
Lord Renly owned a few, with drawings that would turn a septon blind."
Jaime had to smile. "There's none of that here, sir. But the histories will open your eyes. You would do well to know about the lives of those who went before."
"I do. Prince Aemon, the Dragon Knight, Sir Ryam Redwyn, the Great Heart, Barristan the Bold,
Gawain Corbray, Alan Connington, the Demon of Dowry. Aye, you will have heard of Lucamore Strong as well.
Sir Lucamore, the Lusty?"
Sir Loras seemed amused.
"Three wives and 30 children, was it? They cut his cock off. Shall I sing the song for you, my lord?"
"And Sir Terence Toyne
bedded the king's mistress and died screaming. The lesson is, men who wear white breeches need to keep them tightly laced."
"Giles Greycloak, Orville the open-handed."
"Giles was a traitor. Orville, a coward. Men who shamed the white cloak. What is my lord suggesting?"
"Oh, little and less. Don't take offence when none was meant, sir.
How about Long Tom Costain?"
Sir Loras shook his head. "He was a Kingsguard knight for 60 years.
"When was that? I've never—"
"Sir Donal of Duskendale, then."
"Well, I may have heard the name, but—"
"Addison Hill? The White Owl? Michael Mertens? Geoffrey Norcross? They called him Never Yield. Red Robert Flowers? What can you tell me of them?"
"Flowers is a bastard name. So is Hill.
Yet both men rose to command the King's Guard. Their tales are in the book. Roland Darklyn is in here, too. The youngest man ever to serve in the King's Guard until me. He was given his cloak on a battlefield, and died within an hour of donning it. He can't have been very good.
Oh, good enough.
He died, but his king lived. A lot of brave men have worn the white cloak. Most have been forgotten.
Most deserve to be forgotten. The heroes will always be remembered. The best."
"The best and the worst. So one of us is like to live in a song. And a few who were a bit of both. Like him." He tapped the page he had been reading.
"Who?"
Sir Loras craned his head around to see.
10 black pellets on a scarlet field? I do not know those arms.
They belong to Criston Cole, who served the first Viserys and the second Aegon. Jamie closed the white book. They called him Kingmaker.
Cersei. Three wretched fools with a leather sack, the queen thought as they sank to their knees before her. The look of them did not encourage her.
I suppose there's always a chance.
Your Grace, said Qyburn quietly, the small council will await my pleasure. It may be that we can bring them word of a traitor's death.
Off across the city, the bells of Baelor's Sept sang their song of mourning.
No bells will ring for you, Tyrion, Cersei thought. I shall dip your head in tar and give your twisted body to the dogs.
Off your knees, she told the would-be lords. Show me what you've brought me.
They rose, three ugly men and ragged. One had a boil on his neck, and none had washed in half a year. The prospect of raising such to lordship amused her. I could seat them next to Margaery at feasts. When the chief fool undid the drawstring on his sack and plunged his hand inside, the smell of decay filled her audience chamber like some rank rose. The head he pulled out was grey-green and crawling with maggots.
It smells like father,
Dorcas gasped, and Jocelyn covered her mouth and retched. The queen considered her prize unflinching.
You've killed the wrong dwarf, she said at last, grudging every word.
We never did, one of the fools dared to say. This has got to be him, sir, a dwarf, see? He's rotted some, is all.
He's also grown a new nose, Cersei observed. A rather bulbous one, I'd say. Tyrion's nose was hacked off in a battle. The three fools exchanged a look.
No one told us, said the one with the head in hand. This one come walking along as bold as you please. Some ugly dwarf, so we thought. He said he were a sparrow,
the one with the boil added.
And you said he was lying.
That was directed at the third man. The queen was angry to think that she had kept her small council waiting for this mummer's farce.
You have wasted my time and slain an innocent man. I should have your heads off.
But if she did, the next man might hesitate and let the imp slip the net. She would pile dead dwarfs 10 feet high before she let that happen.
Remove yourselves from my sight. Aye, your grace, said the boil. We beg your pardons. Do you want the head?
Asked the man who held it.
Give it to Sir Merrin. No, in the sack, you lackwit.
Yes, Sir Osmond, see them out. Trent removed the head and Kettle Black the headsman, leaving only Lady Jocelyn's breakfast as evidence of their visit.
Clean that up at once,
the queen commanded her. This was the third head that had been delivered to her. At least, this one was a dwarf. The last had simply been an ugly child.
Someone will find the dwarf, never fear, Sir Osmond assured her. And when they do, we'll kill him good.
Will you? Last night Cersei had dreamed of the old woman with the pebbly jowls and croaking voice. Maggie the Frog, they had called her, in Lannisbourne. If father had known what she said to me, he would have had her tongue out. Cersei had never told anyone, though, not even Jaime. Melara said that if we never spoke about her prophecies, we would forget them. She said that a forgotten prophecy couldn't come true.
I have informer sniffing after the imp everywhere, your grace, said Qyburn.
He had garbed himself in something very like maester's robes, but white instead of grey, immaculate as the cloaks of the king's guard. Walls of gold decorated his hem, sleeves, and stiff high collar, and a golden sash was tied about his waist.
Old Town, Gold Town, Dorne, even the Free Cities. Wheresoever he might run, my whisperers will find him.
You assume he left King's Landing?
He could be hiding in Bale or Sept, all we know, swinging on the bell ropes to make that awful din. Cersei made a sour face and let Dorcas help her to her feet. Come, my lord, my counsel awaits. She took Qyburn by the arm as they made their way down the stairs. Have you attended to that, little task I set you?
I have, Your Grace. I'm sorry it took so long, such a large head. It took the beetles many hours to clean the flesh. By way of pardon, I have lined a box of ebony and silver with felt to make a fitting presentation for the skull. A cloth sack would serve as well. Prince Doran wants his head. He won't give a fig what sort of box it comes in.
The pealing of the bells was louder in the yard.
He was only a high septon. How long must we endure this?
The ringing was more melodious than the mountain screams had been, but Qyburn seemed to sense what she was thinking.
The bells will stop at sunset, Your Grace.
That will be a great relief. How can you know?
Knowing is the nature of my service.
Varys had all of us believing he was irreplaceable. What fools we were. Once a queen, let it become known that Qyburn had taken the eunuch's place. The usual vermin had wasted no time in making themselves known to him, to trade their whispers for a few coins. It was the silver all along, not the spider. Qyburn will serve us just as well. She was looking forward to the look on Pycelle's face when Qyburn took his seat. A knight of the King's Guard was always posted outside the doors of the council chamber when the small council was in session. Today it was Sir Boris Blunt.
"Sir Boris," the Queen said pleasantly, "you look quite grey this morning. Something you ate, perchance?"
Jamie had made him the King's food taster. A tasty task, but shameful for a knight. Blunt hated it. His sagging jowls quivered as he held the door for them. The councillors quieted as she entered. Lord Giles coughed by way of greeting, loud enough to wake Pycelle. The others rose, mouthing pleasantries. Cersei allowed herself the faintest of smiles.
"My lords, I know you will forgive my lateness."
"We are here to serve, Your Grace," said Sir Harry Swift. "It is our pleasure to anticipate your coming."
"You all know Lord Qyburn, I'm sure." Grandmaster Pycelle did not disappoint her.
"Lord Qyburn?" He managed purpling, "Your Grace, this maester swears sacred vows to hold no lands or lordships."
"Your citadel took away his chain," Cersei reminded him. "If he is not a maester, he cannot be held to a maester's vows. We called the eunuch lord as well, you may recall."
Pycelle sputtered. "This man is... he is unfit. Do not presume to speak to me of fitness, not after the stinking mockery you made of my lord father's corpse." "Your Grace cannot think—"
He raised a spotted hand as if to ward off a blow.
"The silent sisters removed Lord Tywin's bowels and organs, drained his blood. Every care was taken. His body was stuffed with salts and fragrant herbs."
"Oh, spare me the disgusting details. I smell the results of your care. Lord Qyburn's healing arts saved my brother's life, and I do not doubt that he will serve the king more ably than that simpering eunuch. My lord, you know your fellow councillors?"
"I would be a poor informer if I did not, Your Grace."
Qyburn seated himself between Orton Merryweather and Giles Rusby.
"My councillors."
Cersei had uprooted every rose and all those beholding to her uncle and her brothers. In their places were men whose loyalty would be to her. She had even given them new styles, borrowed from the free cities. The queen would have no masters at court beside herself. Orton Merryweather was her justiciar, Giles Rusby her lord treasurer. Orrin Walters, the dashing young bastard of Driftmark, would be her grand admiral. And for a hand, Sir Harry Swift. Soft, bald, and obsequious,
Swift had an absurd little white puff of beard where most men had a chin. The blue bantam rooster of his house was worked across the front of his plush yellow doublet in beads of lapis.